The Original Affluent Society by Marshall Salins. Hunter-gatherers. Hunter-gatherers consume less energy per capita per year than any other group of human beings. Yet, when you come to examine it, the original affluent society was none other than the hunters, in which all people's material wants were easily satisfied. To accept that hunters are affluent is therefore to recognize that the present human condition of man slaving to bridge the gap between his unlimited wants and his insufficient means is a tragedy of modern times. There are two possible courses to affluence. Wants may be easily satisfied either by producing much or desiring little. The familiar conception, the Galbraithian way, based on the concept of market economies, states that man's wants are great, not to say infinite, whereas his means are limited, although they can be improved. Thus, the gap between means and ends can be narrowed by industrial productivity, at least to the point that urgent goods become plentiful. But there's also a Zen road to affluence, which states that human material wants are finite and few, and technical means unchanging, but on the whole adequate. Adopting the Zen strategy, a people can enjoy an unparalleled material plenty, with a low standard of living. That, I think, describes the hunters. And it helps explain some of their more curious economic behavior. Their prodigality, for example, the inclination to consume at once all stocks on hand, as if they had it made. Free from market obsessions of scarcity, hunters' economic propensities may be more consistently predicated on abundance than our own. D'Estaing de Tracy, fish-blooded bourgeois doctrinaire though he might have been, at least forced Marx to agree that, in poor nations, the people are comfortable, whereas in rich nations, they are generally poor. Sources of the misconception. Mere subsistence economy, limited leisure save in exceptional circumstances, incessant quest for food, meager and relative unreliable natural resources, absence of an economic surplus, maximum energy from a maximum number of people. So runs the fair average anthropological opinion of hunting and gathering. The traditional dismal view of the hunter's fix goes back to the time Adam Smith was writing, and probably to a time before anyone was writing. Probably, it was one of the first distinctly Neolithic prejudices, an ideological appreciation of the hunter's capacity to exploit the Earth's resources most congenial to the historic task of depriving him of the same. We must have inherited it with the seed of Jacob, which spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north, to the disadvantage of Esau, who was the elder son and cunning hunter, but in a famous scene deprived of his birthright. Current low opinions of the hunter-gathering economy need not be laid to Neolithic ethnocentrism. Bourgeois ethnocentrism will do as well. The existing business economy will promote the same dim conclusions about the hunting life. Is it so paradoxical to contend that hunters have affluent economies, their absolute poverty notwithstanding? Modern capitalist societies, however richly endowed, dedicate themselves to the proposition of scarcity. Inadequacy of economic means is the first principle of the world's wealthiest peoples. The market industrial system institutes scarcity in a manner completely without parallel. Where production and distribution are arranged through the behavior of prices, and all livelihoods depend on getting and spending, insufficiency of material means becomes the explicit, calculable starting point of all economic activity. The entrepreneur is confronted with alternative investments of a finite capital, the worker, hopefully, with alternative choices of remunerative employ, and the consumer. Consumption is a double tragedy. What begins in inadequacy will end in deprivation. Bringing together an international division of labor, the market makes available a dazzling array of products. All these good things within a man's reach, but never all within his grasp. Worse, in this game of consumer free choice, every acquisition is simultaneously a deprivation, for every purchase of something is a foregoing of something else. In general, only marginally less desirable, and in some particulars more desirable, that could have been had instead. That sentence of life at hard labor was passed uniquely upon us. Scarcity is the judgment decreed by our economy. And it is precisely from this anxious vantage that we look back upon hunters. But if modern man, with all his technological advances, still lacks the wherewithal, what chance has the naked savage with his puny bow and arrow? Having equipped the hunter with bourgeois impulses and Paleolithic tools, we judge his situation hopeless in advance. Yet, scarcity is not an intrinsic property of technical means. It is a relation between means and ends. We should entertain the empirical possibility that hunters are in business for their health, a finite objective, and that bow and arrow are adequate to that end. The anthropological disposition to exaggerate the economic inefficiency of hunters appears notably by way of invidious comparison with Neolithic economies. Hunters, as Lowy put it blankly, must work much harder in order to live than tillers and breeders. On this point, evolutionary anthropology, in particular, found it congenial, even necessary theoretically, to adopt the usual tone of approach. Ethnologists and archaeologists had become Neolithic revolutionaries, and in their enthusiasm for the revolution spared nothing in denouncing the old Stone Age regime. It was not the first time philosophers would relegate the earliest stage of humanity rather to nature than to culture. A man who spends his whole life following animals just to kill them to eat or moving from one berry patch to another is really living just like an animal himself. The hunters thus downgraded, anthropology was freer to extol the Neolithic Great Leap Forward, a main technological advance that brought about a general availability of leisure through release from purely food-getting pursuits. In an influential essay on energy and the evolution of culture, Leslie White explained that the Neolithic generated a great advance in cultural development as a consequence of the great increase in the amount of energy harnessed and controlled per capita per year by means of the agricultural and pastoral arts. White further heightened the evolutionary contrast by specifying human effort as the principal energy source of Paleolithic culture, as opposed to the domesticated plant and animal resources of Neolithic culture. This determination of the energy sources at once permitted a precise low estimate of hunters' thermodynamic potential. That developed by the human body, average power resources of 1/20th horsepower per capita, even as, by eliminating human effort from the cultural enterprise of the Neolithic, it appeared that people had been liberated by some labor-saving device, domesticated plants and animals. But White's problematic is obviously misconceived. The principal mechanical energy available to both Paleolithic and Neolithic culture is that supplied by human beings, as transformed in both cases from plant and animal source, so that, with negligible exceptions, the occasional direct use of non-human power, the amount of energy harnessed per capita per year is the same in Paleolithic and Neolithic economies, and fairly constant in human history until the advent of the Industrial Revolution. Marvelously varied diet. Marginal as the Australian or Kalahari Desert is to agriculture, or to everyday European experience, it is a source of wonder to the untutored observer how anybody could live in a place like this. The inference that the natives manage only to eke out a bare existence is apt to be reinforced by their marvelously varied diets. Ordinarily, including objects deemed repulsive and inedible by Europeans, the local cuisine lends itself to the supposition that the people are starving to death. It is a mistake, Sir George Grey wrote, to suppose that the native Australians have small means of subsistence or are at times greatly pressed for want of food. Many and almost ludicrous are the errors travelers have fallen into in this regard. They lament in their journals that the unfortunate aborigines should be reduced by famine to the miserable necessity of subsisting on certain sorts of food which they have found near their huts, whereas, in many instances, the articles thus quoted by them are those which the natives most prize, and are really neither deficient in flavor nor nutritious qualities. To render palpable the ignorance that has prevailed with regard to the habits and customs of this people when in their wild state, Gray provides one remarkable example, a citation from his fellow explorer, Captain Stewart, who, upon encountering a group of aboriginals engaged in gathering large quantities of mimosa gum, deduced that the unfortunate creatures were reduced to the last extremity and, being unable to procure any other nourishment, had been obliged to collect this mucilaginous. But, Sir George observes, the gum in question is a favorite article of food in the area, and when in season, it affords the opportunity for large numbers of people to assemble and camp together, which otherwise they're unable to do. He concludes, generally speaking, the natives live well. In some districts, there may be at particular seasons of the year a deficiency of food, but if such is the case, these tracts are, at those times, deserted. It is, however, utterly impossible for a traveler or even for a strange native to judge whether a district affords an abundance of food or the contrary. But in his own district, a native is very differently situated. He knows exactly what it produces, the proper time at which the several articles are in season, and the readiest means of procuring them. According to these circumstances, he regulates his visits to different portions of his hunting ground, and I can only say that I have always found the greatest abundance in their huts. In making this happy assessment, Sir George took special care to exclude the lumpen proletariat aboriginals living in and about European towns. The exception instructive. It evokes a second source of ethnographic misconceptions. The anthropology of hunters is largely an anachronistic study of ex-savages, an inquest into the corpse of one society, Gray once said, presided over by members of another. A kind of material plenty. Considering the poverty in which hunters and gatherers live in theory, it comes as a surprise that bushmen who live in the Kalahari enjoy a kind of material plenty, at least in the realm of everyday useful things, apart from food and water. As the Chukung come into more contact with Europeans, and this is already happening, they will feel sharply the lack of our things and will need and want more. It makes them feel inferior to be without clothes when they stand among strangers who are clothed. But in their own life and with their own artifacts, they were comparatively free from material pressures. Except for food and water, important exceptions, of which the Nyai Nyai Kung have a sufficiency, but barely so, judging from the fact that they are all thin, though not emaciated, they all had what they needed, or can make what they needed, for every man can and does make the things that men make, and every woman the things that women make. They lived in a kind of material plenty, because they adapted the tools of their living to materials which lay in abundance around them, and which were free for anybody to take. Wood, reeds, bone for weapons and implements, fibers for cordage, grass for shelters, or to materials which were at least sufficient for the needs of the population. The Chukung could always use more ostrich eggshells for beads to wear or trade with, but, as it is, enough are found for every woman to have a dozen or more shells for water containers, all she can carry, and a goodly number of bead ornaments. In their nomadic hunting-gathering life, traveling from one source of food to another through the seasons, always going back and forth between food and water, they carry their young children and their belongings, with plenty of most materials at hand to replace artifacts as required. The Chukung have not developed means of permanent storage and have not needed or wanted to encumber themselves with surpluses or duplicates. They do not even want to carry one of everything. They borrow what they do not own. With this ease, they have not hoarded, and the accumulation of objects has not become associated with status. In the non-subsistence sphere, the people's wants are generally easily satisfied. Such material plenty depends partly upon the simplicity of technology and democracy of property. Products are homespun of stone, bone, wood, skin materials, such as lay in abundance around them. As a rule, neither extraction of the raw material nor its working up takes strenuous effort. Access to natural resources is typically direct, free for anyone to take, even as possession of the necessary tools is general and knowledge of the required skills common. The division of labor is likewise simple, predominantly a division of labor by sex. Add in the liberal customs of sharing, for which hunters are properly famous, and all the people can usually participate in the going prosperity such as it is. For most hunters, such affluence without abundance in the non-subsistence sphere need not be long debated. A more interesting question is why they are content with so few possessions, for it is with them a policy, a matter of principle, as Gusin says, and not a misfortune. But are hunters so undemanding of material goods because they are themselves enslaved by a food quest, demanding maximum energy from a maximum number of people, so that no time or effort remains for the provision of other comforts? Some ethnographers testify to the contrary, that the food quest is so successful that half the time, the people seem not to know what to do with themselves. On the other hand, movement is a condition of this success. More movement in some cases than others, but always enough to rapidly depreciate the satisfactions of property. Of the hunter, it is truly said that his wealth is a burden. In his condition of life, goods can become grievously oppressive, as Gussend observes, and the more so the longer they're carried around. Certain food collectors do have canoes and a few have dog sleds, but most must carry themselves all the comforts they possess, and so only possess what they can comfortably carry themselves. Or perhaps only what the women can carry. The men are often left free to reach the sudden opportunity of the chase or the sudden necessity of defense. As Owen Lattimore wrote in a not too different context, the pure nomad is the poor nomad. Mobility and property are in contradiction. That wealth quickly becomes more of an encumbrance than a good thing is apparent even to the outsider. Lorenz van der Post was caught in the contradiction as he prepared to make farewells to his wild bushman friends. This matter of presence gave us many an anxious moment. We were humiliated by the realization of how little there was we could give to the bushmen. Almost everything seemed likely to make life more difficult for them by adding to the litter and weight of their daily round. They themselves had practically no possessions. A loin strap, a skin blanket, and a leather satchel. There was nothing that they could not assemble in 1 minute, wrap up in their blankets, and carry on their shoulders for a journey of 1,000 miles. They had no sense of possession. Here, then, is another economic peculiarity. Some hunters, at least, display a notable tendency to be sloppy about their possessions. They have the kind of nonchalance that would be appropriate to a people who have mastered the problem of production. They do not know how to take care of their belongings. No one dreams of putting them in order, folding them, drying or cleaning them, hanging them up, or putting them in a neat pile. They are looking for some particular thing. They rummage carelessly through the hodgepodge of trifles in the little baskets. Larger objects that are piled up in a heap in the hut are dragged hither and thither with no regard for the damage that might be done them. The European observer has the impression that these Yagan Indians place no value whatever on their utensils, and that they have completely forgotten the effort it took to make them. Actually, no one clings to his few goods and chattels, which, as it is, are often and easily lost, but just as easily replaced. The Indian does not even exercise care when he could conveniently do so. A European is likely to shake his head at the boundless indifference of these people who drag brand new objects, precious clothing, fresh provisions, and valuable items through thick mud, or abandon them to their swift destruction by children and dogs. Expensive things that are given them are treasured for a few hours, out of curiosity. After that, they thoughtlessly let everything deteriorate in the mud and wet. The less they own, the more comfortable they can travel, and what is ruined they occasionally replace. Hence, they are completely indifferent to any material possessions. The hunter, one is tempted to say, is uneconomic man. At least as concerns non-subsistence goods, he is the reverse of that standard caricature immortalized in any General Principles of Economics, page 1. His wants are scarce, and his means, in relation, plentiful. Consequently, he is comparatively free of material pressures, has no sense of possession, shows an undeveloped sense of property, is completely indifferent to any material pressures, and manifests a lack of interest in developing his technological equipment. In this relation of hunters to worldly goods, there is a neat and important point. From the internal perspective of the economy, it seems wrong to say that wants are restricted, desires restrained, or even that the notion of wealth is limited. Such phrasings imply, in advance, an economic man and a struggle of the hunter against his own worst nature, which is finally then subdued by a cultural vow of poverty. The words imply the renunciation of an acquisitiveness that in reality was never developed, a suppression of desires that were never broached. Economic man is a bourgeois construction, as Marcel Mauss said, not behind us, but before, like the moral man. It is not that hunters and gatherers have curbed their materialistic impulses. They simply never made an institution of them. Moreover, if it is a great blessing to be free from a great evil, our Montagne savages are happy, for the two tyrants who provide hell and torture for many of our Europeans do not reign in their great forests. I mean ambition and avarice, as they are contented with a mere living. Not one of them gives himself to the devil to acquire wealth. Subsistence. When Herskovitz was writing his Economic Anthropology, 1958, it was common anthropological practice to take the Bushmen, or the native Australians, as a classic illustration of a people whose economic resources are of the scantest, so precariously situated that only the most intense application makes survival possible. Today, the classic understanding can be fairly reversed, on evidence largely from these two groups. A good case can be made that hunters and gatherers work less than we do, and, rather than a continuous travail, the food quest is intermittent, leisure abundant, and there is a greater amount of sleep in the daytime per capita per year than in any other condition of society. The most obvious immediate conclusion is that the people do not work hard. The average length of time per person per day put into the appropriation and preparation of food was 4 or 5 hours. Moreover, they do not work continuously. The subsistence quest was highly intermittent. It would stop for the time being when the people had procured enough for the time being, which left them plenty of time to spare. Clearly, in subsistence, as in other sectors of production, we have to do with an economy of specific limited objectives. By hunting and gathering, these objectives are apt to be irregularly accomplished, so the work pattern becomes correspondingly erratic. As for the Bushmen, economically likened to Australian hunters by Herskovitz, two excellent recent reports by Richard Lee show their condition to be indeed the same. Lee's research merits a special hearing not only because it concerns Bushmen, but specifically the Dobe section of Kung Bushmen, adjacent the Nyai, about whose subsistence in a context otherwise of material plenty, Miss Marshall expressed important reservations. The Dobe occupy an area of Botswana where Chikung Bushmen have been living for at least 100 years, but have only just begun to suffer dislocation pressures. Abundance. Despite a low annual rainfall, 6 to 10 inches, Lee found in the Dobe area a surprising abundance of vegetation. Food resources were both varied and abundant, particularly the energy-rich Mangetti nut, so abundant that millions of the nuts rotted on the ground each year for want of picking. The Bushmen figures imply that one man's labor in hunting and gathering will support 4 or 5 people. Taken at face value, Bushmen food collecting is more efficient than French farming in the period up to World War II, when more than 20% of the population were engaged in feeding the rest. Confessedly, the comparison is misleading, but not as misleading as it is astonishing. In the total population of free-ranging Bushmen contracted by Lee, 61.3%, 152 of 248, were effective food producers. The remainder were too young or too old to contribute importantly. In the particular camp under scrutiny, 65% were effectives. Thus, the ratio of food producers to the general population is actually 3 to 5 or 2 to 3. But these 65% of the people worked 36% of the time, and 35% of the people did not work at all. For each adult worker, this comes to about 2.5 days labor per week. In other words, each productive individual supported herself or himself in dependence and still had 3 to 5 days available for other activities. A day's work was about 6 hours, hence the Dobe work week is approximately 15 hours, or an average of 2 hours 9 minutes per day. All things considered, Bushmen subsistent labors are probably very close to those of native Australians. Also like the Australians, the time bushmen do not work in subsistence, they pass in leisure or leisurely activity. One detects again that characteristically Paleolithic rhythm of a day or two on, a day or two off. The latter pass desultorily in camp. Although food collecting is the primary productive activity, Lee writes, the majority of the people's time, 4 to 5 days per week, is spent in other pursuits, such as resting in camp or visiting other camps. A woman gathers on one day enough food to feed her family for 3 days, and spends the rest of her time resting in camp, doing embroidery, visiting other camps, or entertaining visitors from other camps. For each day at home, kitchen routines such as cooking, nut cracking, collecting firewood, and fetching water occupy 1 to 3 hours of her time. This rhythm of steady work and steady leisure maintained throughout the year. The hunters tend to work more frequently than the women, but their schedule uneven. It is not unusual for a man to hunt avidly for a week and then do no hunting at all for 2 or 3 weeks. Since hunting is an unpredictable business and subject to magical control, hunters sometimes experience a run of bad luck and stop hunting for a month or longer. During these periods, visiting, entertaining, and especially dancing are the primary activities of men. The daily per capita subsistence yield for the Dobe Bushmen was 2,140 calories. However, taking into account body weight, normal activities, and the age-sex composition of the Dobe population, Lee estimates the people require only 1,975 calories per capita. Some of the surplus food probably went to the dogs, who ate what the people left over. The conclusion can be drawn that the Bushmen do not lead a substandard existence on the edge of starvation, as has been commonly supposed. Meanwhile, back in Africa, the Hadza have been long enjoying a comparable ease, with a burden of subsistence occupations no more strenuous in hours per day than the Bushmen or the Australian Aboriginals. Living in an area of exceptional abundance of animals and regular supplies of vegetables, the vicinity of Lake Ayasi, Hadza men seem much more concerned with games of chance than with chances of game. During the long dry season especially, they pass the greater part of days on end in gambling, perhaps only to lose the metal-tipped arrows they need for big game hunting at other times. In any case, many men are quite unprepared or unable to hunt big game even when they possess the necessary arrows. Only a small minority, Woodburn writes, are active hunters of large animals, and if women are generally more assiduous in their vegetable collecting, still, it is at a leisurely pace and without prolonged labor. Despite this nonchalance and an only limited economic cooperation, Hadza nonetheless obtain sufficient food without undue effort. Woodburn offers this very rough approximation of subsistence labor requirements. Over the year as a whole, probably an average of less than 2 hours a day spent obtaining food. It is interesting that the Hadza, tutored by life and not by anthropology, reject the Neolithic Revolution in order to keep their leisure. Although surrounded by cultivators, they have until recently refused to take up agriculture themselves, mainly on the grounds that this would involve too much hard work. In this, they are like the Bushmen, who respond to the Neolithic question with another. Why should we plant when there are so many mongo-mongo nuts in the world? Woodburn, moreover, did form the impression, although as yet unsubstantiated, that Hadza actually expend less energy and probably less time obtaining subsistence than do neighboring cultivators of East Africa. To change continents, but not contents, the fitful economic commitment of the South American hunter, too, could seem to the European outsider an incurable natural disposition. The Yamana are not capable of continuous daily hard labor, much to the chagrin of European farmers and employers for whom they often work. Their work is more a matter of fits and starts, and in these occasional efforts they can develop considerable energy for a certain time. After that, however, they show a desire for an incalculably long rest period during which they lie about doing nothing without showing great fatigue. It is obvious that repeated irregularities of this kind make the European employer despair, but the Indian cannot help it. It is his natural disposition. The hunter's attitude towards farming introduces us, lastly, to a few particulars of the way they relate to the food quest. Once again, we venture here into the internal realm of the economy, a realm sometimes subjective and always difficult to understand, where, moreover, hunters seem deliberately inclined to overtax our comprehension by customs so odd as to invite the extreme interpretation that either these people are fools, or they really have nothing to worry about. The former would be a true logical deduction from the hunter's nonchalance, on the premise that his economic condition is truly exigent. On the other hand, if a livelihood is usually easily procured, if one can usually expect to succeed, then the people's seeming imprudence can no longer appear as such. Speaking to unique developments of